But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
All right, hello everybody, and welcome on back to your weekly programming, Nomad Verbal Shenanigans. I am Scott, and that is Mike. Mike, say hello.
I don't want to.
All right, thank God. The fans are happy. He's pleasing the fans, everybody. He's pleasing the fans. But welcome back to another edition of our weekly show here. If you're just tuning in, we are a weekly podcast that we, every week we try to bring on interesting guests and do some bits and talk about life and whatnot. And, I guess that kind of sums us up pretty well. Brother, we're coming off a fun one last week. It's Stu Cook from a little band that's trying to make it. They're doing the club circuit now. Something by the name of Creedence Clearwater.
I don't like that new age tech stuff, Scotty, so I don't know. I'm glad I held my ground. I'm like, no, I'm not talking to Stu.
that's why you weren't there. You were like, I don't do these interviews. I don't mess with small time small staff here. But
listen, when you got mustache champions, Berlew is stacked. Mm-hmm. But
prepare
this guy. Nah.
Yeah, so last week, it was a real honor to talk to Stu Cook of Creedence Clearwater, a band that, I don't know anybody that dislikes Creedence Clearwater. And I randomly come across, like, different phases where I'm like, I go on, like, a Creedence Clearwater, like, wormhole for, like, a week. I'm like, oh, I'm playing, Bad Moon Rising, like, every morning on the way to work. So it was really cool to somehow get hooked up with him through. And it all came from... what that all stemmed from was a couple months ago, it was last year, we had talked to Chris Barron of the Spin Doctors, and that took a long time to set up. I was Twitter messaging him and going back and forth, and finally we set that up, and the person who represented him also represented Creedence Clearwater Revisited, which Stu's doing right now, and then we were able to talk to him. So, and the other thing that's pretty cool is, I played bass for a long time. I don't really play too much anymore. I would like to. I know one day I'll dive back into it, but I played bass growing up, which is, as you know, bass is like when the guitar and drums and singer are taken, there's the one instrument that's got to be played, and it's like the forgotten instrument. None of the cool guys ever play bass.
It's the part of the band where, like, pick it up, play that one note while we're doing our thing, you'll be good.
Yeah. It usually starts with somebody like picking up, like, well, I have a bass in my garage and we already have a guitar player. All right, I'll be the bass player. But it really cool to think now. Over some time now, we've talked to a couple bass players who I've kind of looked up to. So there was Stu last week, which, I know their music a lot. But before that, we had Ed Breckenridge from Thrice, who is brothers with Riley. And then we also had who I consider like the greatest living bassist at the moment, and that's Victor Wooten a couple years ago. And if you haven't seen Victor Wooten, I suggest you, even if you've never had any interest in, like, musicians and bass and stuff like that, go check him out. He's like a wizard on the bass, so we get to talk to him. So it's kind of weird that we've kind of accumulated a little, like, a little pocket of interest that I've had, and it somehow has kind of come full circle. It's cool.
Yeah, we got a little clown in the bass community, probably,
Yeah,
you
I know.
We can... If there's like a bass only bar, we can like knock on it and they'll be like, you're not on the list. I'm like, oh, Verbal Shenanigans ain't on the list. And they're like, oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Berlew. Come on in.
Hey, I'm all about that bass, but Yeah, the bass bar would be like all the like all the outcasts from bands that like nobody knows who they are, but they've all done like amazing things, but no one knows you other than like Flea, and Flea and Les Claypool basically, and the guy from Rush, Geddy Lee. That's kind of that's kind of the household basis. Bootsy Collins maybe. But yeah, that's kind of that. So that was last week. So go check that episode out. We also had a very good podcast last week. I got to say, as far as like content, we played some fun games. We got a little deep at one point. We talked about my ridiculous show at the Freemasons Lounge. It was a good week last week.
Yeah. Yeah. Once in a while we hit it.
And what? Yeah.
We're praying that's the week you actually listen to us. There's some of them we're like, no.
Yeah. Yeah. Like when people like we sign up for these services and they're like, well, let us review. We're going to review some of your stuff. We're like, no, don't do last week's.
All right. I'm going to give you three specific numbers. Those are the episodes you can listen to. Do not go any further back than that.
So, guys, I really dove deep into your interview with Zap from American Gladiators, and, I don't know.
My favorite is still Aisha Ash, who picked an episode probably...
Oh, that was a good story, man.
Like, 70 weeks older than what we were on. We'd like... I think she was on like somewhere in the 140s or so, and she
now side note
randomly picked like episode 58, where we were just on some weird rant about, oh, these chicks got to get jobs or something.
Yeah, and it was definitely like tongue in cheek, like joking around, and she like heard it and was like, oh god. And now Aisha Ash, side note, was like a this African American ballet dancer who was like really, really cool guest. But she's like, I guess I'll do an interview with you guys. I don't know.
I had to call her during a lunch break at one time and explain to her, no, that's not our weekly bit. We don't every week yell about women getting jobs and then invite women to talk to about why don't you have a job?
Although, you know? No, I'm signing up right now to start that podcast so nobody steals it.
Dancing is not a serious job. What are you doing, Aisha Ash?
I'm Scott, and I'm Mike, and this is Women Bashing. Welcome to... Last week, we made fun of housewives. This week, we're going to talk about why women can't be firemen.
Aisha Ash just randomly said, I'm going to listen to him again this week.
No! You know, like, the guys, they were fun. Let's tune in to see what they're up to. Oh, no.
She's like Haley's Comet. It's like every 80 episodes, she'll just tune in, you know?
Mike, I get that kind of reminded me real quick. You sent me the other day. You had pissed off another potential client. We've only made a few upset over the years, so let's not make it sound like we upset everybody. But we upset someone who you know what? You should message the guy you pissed off about the missing children and send him our John Walsh interview and be like, yeah, I got the kingpin of missing children. That sounds weird. The kingpin of helping.
We got to go back and rename that episode.
I got the guy who's probably helped the most missing children and put things in place so children aren't missing. So, ha! Yeah. No one knows what I'm talking about.
Explain to our new fans what Scott's talking about is me and him both go through different ways to try to contact different people to come on to our show. And I came across a gentleman who was a Bigfoot hunter, and also on the side, he actually tries to find missing children, and we have this like form email that we do where we list out all of our guests and we explain what we're looking for, and I tell him, you know, we want to talk to you about the Bigfoot, and we also want to learn more about your group that helps try to find missing children, and he replied back probably a couple days later, basically saying, I don't think it's funny to make fun of missing children. No, thank you, for lack of a better term.
Right.
And I sent it back to him. I'm like, no, I know what the name of the show is, but we're not making fun of people. I can show you examples like that. And he just never replied after that. So
yeah, I pissed
somewhere
off
in the world. This guy is like telling all his friends, this dude just laughs at missing children all day long,
which is accurate, but we thought we threw him off your trail. You threw him
yeah.
off.
Yeah. We hate women who don't work, and we laugh at missing children. That's what verbal shenanigans is all about.
That's the one clip Aisha has. She's going to put like her cursor on a thing and drop it randomly, and she's going to hear that quote. Bad for business.
Yeah, so what Scott was alluding to, I don't think I pissed him off, but as I try to find more weird and interesting guests, I was trying to get onto the show. A company that basically does the special needs who give out monkey helpers.
Yeah.
So the only thing you might have seen it. Sadly, I think they mock it a lot. But you see, like the guy who's like paralyzed in the wheelchair, and a monkey goes around the house and does certain tasks for people. So I've been working on that for.
Yep.
What? Probably close to a year.
Yep.
Almost. So I went through like one person, and she was super excited about us. Like she it was a week Victor Wooten was on her show, and like she even said, "Oh, I listened to that
God,
episode."
That's how far
amazing.
Back.
Yeah, that's how far back it was. She was like, "Oh, I love Victor Wooten. I listened to it. It was so amazing." She took all the info. She was like really supporting to get us through, and she's like, you know, the council met, and I think they called it the social media council, and I'm sorry they didn't select you, and
now,
I'm like,
now,
okay.
Now let me say something. So Victor Wooten, I just put it up last week or 2 weeks ago. Victor Wooten was episode 143, meaning that was almost 100 episodes ago, meaning close to 2 years ago. You've been working on getting – now I'm also thinking –
I was Jersey when I was working on them, so yeah.
I'm also laughing at the Monkey Helper Council meeting like once
– No. It's the Monkey Helper Social Media Council.
Today we have business before the board. Shut up!
Bunch of like 70-year-old men in suits with monkeys running around. Stop it, you bananas! We have business to take care of.
Those in favor of going on the Verbal Shenanigans program, please beat your chest. Ooh, ooh.
I'm terribly sorry. It was 5-3. No.
Those who say nay, throw shit at the wall.
Bubbles, you already voted. Don't do that. So we got rejected then. And then once in a while, I'd like to go through like my old ones and try to reconnect and try to get guests who might have said yay or nay or reconnect to see if anything changed. And I tried to email, and the girl who liked us is no longer with the company, so I had to go through another person and I had to re-explain who we are. And she was nice to me, but the weird thing is about this monkey helper's place is that
the one weird thing.
Yeah, just one item that you know really grinds my gears. They needed every ounce of information about us. They wanted to know all of our downloads, you know, what's our history, what kind of stuff we've done with other charity stuff. And they literally wanted us to list out every single question we were going to ask on the interview. And even before I had time to put out said list, I got the rejection letter.
Ah, which by the way, like, is never a good way to go into an interview. Like, we like to do I know personally, I like to do my research. Sometimes, you know, I like it a little bit more off the cuff, depending on the guest. If it's someone like that, I would do a little research. If it's someone I know well, not well personally, but, like, know of their work well, I like to let it be a little bit more organic. And sometimes questions pop into your head. Like, if they were like, hey, can you give us a couple bullet points, what you want us to talk about? I get that. But every question, then it becomes this verbatim script, you know? Like think about 3 weeks ago or two episodes ago, whatever it was, we had the guy from the Kentucky Reptile Zoo. And we thought, I thought a lot of our questions were going to be about snakes and reptiles. It turned out to, it kind of went to a complete other place that we never expected. He was like an MMA fighter going through to try to raise money to study reptile. He lost fingers. And it was like a really cool interview. And I can't imagine being scripted with these monkey guys. Like, where do you get the monkeys from? Like, it just, that's not our style. And I don't think any interview, like all the interviews I listen to, podcasts and great interviews, I don't think they're ever that stiff and rigid. You know, like the good one.
I can't fathom. I mean, anybody who asks every single question is petrified to be on there as is, and it, it's never going to be natural or fun, regardless if they know what's coming. It's just right. going to be blatant. I'm going to have the answer ready and read off this list and tell you, yes, we get the monkeys from North Carolina. The monkey capital of the world, well, as we all know.
Is it? I thought you had told me differently. How did North Carolina become the monkey capital of the world exactly?
Well, it's a fascinating story, Scott.
Really? We have time. Yeah. We got time.
Well, obviously, it's fascinating. I'm not stalling to try to figure out an ad-lib answer to this.
No, I mean, we have time, Mike, so go ahead. I mean, yeah, I feel like our listeners want to know this.
Yeah. Well, in the 17th century, Scott, the 17th? You know, we were still...
So the 1600s.
Going for a while.
Okay.
You know, we were still... using the old school boats and all kind of like Christopher Columbus.
Correct.
To travel around the world.
Okay.
And, you know, barter and trade for items.
Okay.
So the natural port to go down to South America was North Carolina.
Now, what I find interesting about this, you're talking the 17th century, so the 1600s. Yeah. So North Carolina was not really North Carolina at that time, correct?
Yeah. Well, you know, they... The people were there. I mean, they didn't
the indigenous.
Go around calling themselves North Carolinians. They called themselves indigenous. And they were still in the markets for stuff like spices and coffee. And
silk,
items
probably
like that.
Probably silk. And I feel like everyone wanted silk back. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Well, Brazil has wonderful silk.
we'll save that for another time.
Yeah.
Brazil is...
So,
okay.
So
where do the monkeys come in, Mike?
They would come down to South America,
the monkeys,
from what is now North Carolina, and they would bring whatever local fruits that they had available at the time and barter with them for different stuff.
Okay.
So obviously, as they gave away the North Carolina apples to the South Americans, in return, the South Americans would give them bananas. Now, obviously, they don't have all the safeguards as they used to back in the
day.
That's obvious. So,
right.
So, unfortunately, a lot of times you get a lot of stowaways, because when you get a big old box of bananas, you're not checking for every single one. And lo and behold, they would get stowaways from South America, which were our monkey population that came into North America.
So, they loaded these ships full of monkeys.
No. They loaded full of local fruits of South America, which happened to have monkeys stowed away. Like, they would be preparing a box and throwing bananas in there, and some monkey would be like, there's my food. I'm going to jump in. Not realizing there's a monkey in there, they would, you know, hammer out the box and
now,
put them on the ship.
For those of you who don't know, Mike is he's very big into history, and he knows a lot more than he puts out. Like, sometimes he does really bad accents. Sometimes he can't remember words, but he remembers all of history. Like, he's so much smarter than you or I. He is very, like, deep. So every once in a while, he'll educate us on the show about many different things. Now, the question I have is, all these monkeys, like one or two stowaways, they would get off the ship and like, what would they like kill the crew and just leave or just run out of the ship when they leave? And
how would they get back to North Carolina around, you know, it'd take a couple months, but there's plenty of fruit in there for them to eat.
Right.
And when they open up the box, they're like, oh my God, my bananas are gone. And there's this weird animal here, but I guess we'll keep it our local mascot.
Now, it's very interesting to me that, like, all these monkeys lived in North Carolina for so long.
Yeah.
So much so that it became the monkey capital of the world. Yet, I've never heard of a monkey in North Carolina or really anywhere on the East Coast, like living indigenously to the United States. Could you explain how how that exactly happened? How do we not know about the monkeys, but you know it to be the capital of the world?
Well, North Carolinians are not known for bragging, Scott. I mean, they know when the world looks for monkeys, there's only one place to go. But they don't want to just put it out there. They don't want the other animals they're known for to be feel inferior, if you will. Okay. You know, I mean, they're in the top 10 in ferrets in the world. Everybody knows that for a fact.
Well, I knew that.
They're getting within the top 50 of Tar Heels. I think that's an animal, but you know, they're just still trying to figure out scientifically North Carolina. So, but you know, they just want to be known as a community and just be proud of the fact that they're the monkey capital of the world and not have to put it out into your face. You know, it's kind of like when you put on a Philadelphia sports event, they talk about, oh, it's a city of brotherly love, and you look at D.C., oh, it's a nation capital. They're like, we don't want to be solely known as the monkey capital of the world. We know we are, but we want to be diversified with this.
Wow. I mean, it's amazing that you just continuously, you know, educate our listeners like and prove what a valuable asset you are to Verbal Shenanigans. So I thank you for your work. Now, I know that, you know, a couple months ago, about a year ago, we had someone from the Jane Goodall Foundation. And I know that, you know, you kind of let him do most of the talking.
Yes. I'm a good host. I allow the guests to talk.
Was there anything that he said that you didn't find to be truthful?
Well, I mean, the monkeys of North Carolina can talk like the monkeys that Jane Goodall work with. They just have an accent because, you know, they're Southerners. So the way their fingers twitch, that's their accent when they talk to people.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So they'll be doing like sign language, and once in a while somebody be like, what did you say? And like the monkeys would get pissed off. It's like, oh, how do you not understand my Southern accent?
Wow. 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 So all this time that we thought you had a Southern accent, it was because
nothing like North Carolina monkeys. Not in the stratosphere.
Oh, okay. Okay. So Sean Sweeney from the Jane Goodall Foundation, if you're listening, talk to Mike. He can give you some more insight into the behavior of chimpanzees and monkeys, especially in North Carolina.
It's kind of weird. All of our former guests are just happening to listen to this episode all of a sudden.
Yeah. Or anybody listen to this episode. But, Berlew, with that knowledge bomb, my brain needs to kind of reset. And I think it's time to get to our first guest, which I see that you have this strange woman that we don't know sitting next to you. What's going on here?
Scott, as the wife knows everything the husband does, her brain figured out I was doing something slightly Disney, and she decided she had to be a part of this. So
gotcha.
For the first time ever on Verbal Shenanigans, Mrs. Michael Berlew, Isabel Berlew, will be helping us interview a guest tonight.
Okay. And now, those of you who don't know, Mike's wife is absurdly into Disney. Like the fact that Mike's sitting in a room right now where I could see like a very scary Mickey and Minnie and Christmas stuff and all sorts. Oh God! Oh wait! Turn to that wall.
Yes, the Disney ear wall of Izzy.
You know,
as she came upstairs.
At one point, you guys had a kissing wall, and I thought that was kind of interesting. This one blows it out of the water. The Disney ear wall.
Yes, this is. Let me give you a view here, and we will be added to the social media pictures here.
Oh yes,
here's our little corner here.
Well, she got. Anyway, there's definitely a dead body in that room. But Berlew, who do we got on the show today?
Today we are going to be talking to. Oh, as my notes are not here. we did the introduction before. This is the second time you've done this to me, Scott.
I can't remember who it is, who we talked to. All that monkey
talk.
We will
be talking to Christopher Lucas, who is an actor who has done voice acting in the Grand Theft Auto series, but he's also known as an author who wrote Seeing Home, a biography of his father, New York Yankee broadcaster Ed Lucas, and his new book, Top Disney, 100 Top 10 Lists of the Best of Disney, will be coming out this month, so we'll be chatting with him on all his writing and all he's been doing to entertain people.
All right, so let's get Chris Lucas on the line. So, Chris, first off, thanks for giving us a few minutes on the show here. I noticed when we called you, there was a Hasbrook Heights. So are you a Jersey guy?
I am a Jersey guy, yes. Born in Jersey City originally and now live in Bergen County.
Nice. So, yeah, I feel like everybody from Jersey has somehow come through Jersey City or Bayonne or like Union City at some point.
You'd be amazed. I've been all over the world, and everywhere I go, somebody, Hudson County. I'll spread it out to like North Jersey maybe. So it's very rare I meet someone South Jersey, mm-hmm. but Central Jersey, North Jersey, but usually Hudson County, that seems to be the key thing. Maybe it's Ellis Island. I'm not sure. Like everybody kind of passed through here on the way to everywhere else, but.
Right, yeah. My father grew up in Bayonne, my mom in Jersey City, and I swear that everybody in Bayonne knows each other and knows the family and knows the block they grew up on. So
absolutely. Yeah, for a big city, it's like a small town.
Yeah, Bayonne's weird because it kind of feels like a city, but it's only like 3 miles long in total.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Yeah, in total, it's just a room and somebody lives in Cape May. Everybody's up in North Jersey. But you're kind of the king of New Jersey. As I was looking through your notes, on my notes, you were the one who started the Soprano tours in New Jersey, huh?
I did. Well, you did your research. Yeah, HBO came to me because I had done a couple of like Disney tours and other entertainment tours, and they came to me back in, I guess it was when the show started in 99. So somewhere about a couple of months after it started, and they said, hey, you know, we know you're from the area and you like giving tours, and can you give a tour where you would pick people up in Manhattan at HBO's headquarters near Bryant Park and then take them around? And I did it as a lark. I said, okay, and they told me it was going to be one tour, but they didn't tell me the one tour I did would have the AP on there and UPI and someone from the New York Times. I had no idea that I had reporters on the bus. So all I did was take people around Hudson County and show them places that when I was growing up, my parents would say, stay away from there. And now people are paying me money to take them there. So we did the tour and they wrote about it in all these places. And suddenly it took off. And every week I was giving tours of New Jersey for until about 2001 or so. And we'd go, we literally went everywhere. We went to like, you know, the Bada Bing. We went to, these were all real places that they were using and, yep. and the people wanted to see them. So
I remember when I was in college, I went to Ramapo College and I guess they were filming a season where I forget what was his son's name in the show?
AJ.
They were trying to decide like where AJ was going to college or something like that. And like the big rumor on campus that they were choosing Ramapo and they were coming to film that weekend.
Wow.
And like a film crew actually came out, but it was like some crappy documentary student film that everyone thought was the Sopranos, but they ended up not choosing Ramapo. But I guess I want to ask you, you have a lot of different parts to you, I guess I'd say, or parts that you have worked in or experienced. But I guess considering opening day was 3 days ago, 4 days ago, we'll get to your father in a minute, but were you sure. personally like a diehard baseball kid? Was baseball like everything to you, or did you just loosely associate with your dad?
I, you know, it's the second one because baseball was my family business. And, you know, you get two choices when it's a family. You either kind of go as far away from it as you can or you embrace it. And my brother, my older brother, he loves baseball. He's a Mets fan. I think he's adopted. I don't know what happened there, but he loves baseball. So I kind of went the other way. I went towards entertainment and movies and TV, and that became my passion. So I like baseball. I don't dislike it, but I don't follow day in, day out. I'll occasionally watch a game here and there, but it's, you know, it's more certainly my dad and the rest of the family. So I'm there and I'm on the fringes of it, but I'm not like super diehard baseball fan.
So when people say, "Oh my God, that's Phil Rizzuto," you're just like, "Yeah, that's my godfather."
Yeah,
it's the dude in the Money Store commercial.
Well, that's how most people in New Jersey knew him, from the Money Store, so it made him famous. But yeah, I grew up, but because of my dad, this past opening day was his 64th straight covering the Yankees. So I grew up around the stadium. So I, as a kid, I didn't know any, people like Mickey Mantle and Joe DiMaggio and Reggie Jackson. They were just over our house, and we'd hang out with, we'd have dinner with them. So they were just people to me. I didn't see them as these big superstars that other people did. So it was kind of an interesting life to lead, getting to see that side of it.
Now, as we talked about before you came on, you've done some acting. I've seen you've done some voice acting for Grand Theft Auto. And being in the entertainment side, what kind of drew you over to becoming an author? And I guess another part of this question would be, when your first book is about your dad, is it that much easier since you know him, or is it harder considering, it's my dad, I don't want to let him down, or I don't want my first book to be anything off on that, so familiar with my family?
Yeah, it's a combination of the two, really. And strangely, the life of an actor and the life of an author, they're not too different. I mean, they're kind of similar, where you're, once your project is done, it's done, and then you're on to the next thing, and you're hoping that there is a next thing and that it's just as successful. So with the book with my dad, it was, as you say, easy, because of the story. People ask me how long it took me to write the book. Well, in reality, the book itself took 3 months to write, but in my head, I was writing it for 40 years trying to figure out how to put the story together. And so it was easy in that respect. But the hard thing, like you say, is it's my father's story. It's my family's story. It's my story. It's my legacy and my dad's legacy. And that'll be out there forever. So, yeah, I one shot to get it right and make sure that it was. So there was a lot of pressure there. But I think hopefully we pulled it off, and my dad was happy with it. And we were lucky that Derek Jeter had started a publishing company on the year he retired.
Who's
and
that?
He came. Yeah, I know some guy. He used to play in New York, I think. I mean, he's down in Miami now. Got as far away as he could.
Yes.
But he his idol is Michael Jordan, so he wanted to diversify like Jordan and do all these other things. So one of the things, he started a publishing company, and he came to us and sat us down and said, "I want your book to be the first book I publish that's not about." He had done a couple about himself and a couple of kids' books, but he said, "I want yours to be the one." So we had the push from him, and we were fortunate that it became a bestseller, and it kind of took off from there. But there was a lot of pressure on the end of getting it right as far as my father's story, because if the first book doesn't do well, or if I get it wrong the first time, there's not going to be a second chance at it.
Now tell the listeners who don't know exactly who your dad is, we do a little research and see your book, but
sure.
How did your dad get involved with all this, like early on, as far as, covering baseball and getting so close to a professional team, nonetheless doing, college or whatever else, but getting involved in this? How did he actually start?
Well, the thumbnail version, and the reason why his story was so attractive to so many people, is that when he was 12 years old, he ran out to play sandlot baseball with his friends, as all kids do. And he was pitching, and he took his glasses off, and he threw the pitch, and the ball came back at him. And they estimate it's probably 80, 90 miles an hour coming back at him and hit him right between the eyes. And that was 1951. And today, if that happened, they could fix it, and there's all sorts of surgeries, but they had none of that back then. So he went completely blind, and he was 12, and he loved baseball. And everybody said, "Oh, kid, your life is over. Forget it. You're handicapped. There's nothing." It's not like today where we have all sorts of stuff for people that are disabled. So they didn't have that back then. And they told him he was going to be on the corner with a cup and a cane and selling pencils, and he'd be in homes the rest of his life. And he was depressed. So my grandmother wrote letters to all the Brooklyn Dodgers, all the New York Giants, all the New York Yankees. And all she wanted was an autograph or maybe a little note or something to say, "Cheer up." And they all, to a man, the entire team started coming to the hospital and calling my dad and kind of lifting his spirits, because he loved, that was his passion, was baseball. And so Phil Rizzuto, who you mentioned before, he took an interest in my dad, and he said, "When you get out of the hospital, come over to my house. My wife and I will have dinner with you. You can meet my kids." And he would take my dad to ball games, and he took him different places, and he told him, "If you go to school and get a degree, I won't get a job for you, but I'll make introductions and open the door. And if you can do it, then. And so he started when he was in high school, really, actually broadcasting for the Yankees and doing games for them. And he's been doing it now, like I said, 64 years. And he's totally blind. And he was one of the first people in the 60s when he really started his career, started picking up a little more. People always ask me, how can you do it if you're blind? And, well, he doesn't do play-by-play because that wouldn't work, obviously.
You're right.
And that sounds like it went to left field. So he and,
well,
he
John was, Sterling was, might as well be.
Well, that's true. That's happening now. So, but it, my dad was one of the pioneers of color commentary where he would talk to players and he would find out, you know, if their wife just had a baby or what town they were from or, well, if they didn't play baseball, what kind of job would they like and stuff like that. And he would add that to the commentary. And at first, people were really angry. They got letters to WPAX, and the radio said, you know, we don't want to hear this stuff. We just want to hear it. But eventually, now you can't imagine a broadcast without that sort of thing. So he was not the first, but he was among the people that started doing that. And he's won an Emmy Award and all these wonderful things. So the book basically was written about that. But then the sub-story is when I was 2 and my older brother was 4, my mother just walked out on us and left my father to raise us all by himself. And so that's why we went to the ballpark all the time. And then 10 years later, she came back and she sued him for custody, saying a blind man shouldn't be raising kids all by himself. She had been gone for a while. And the judge, without hearing any testimony, gave my brother and I to her. And my dad had to go all the way up to the Supreme Court, and he had to fight it, this decision. And it took 2 years. And he had people like, you know, the Yankees testify for him, George Steinbrenner, Bob Hope, Richard Nixon, all these people that he had met throughout his career. And they all said, you know, hey, we've seen the kids and we know what he's in. And he wound up winning, and he became the first handicapped person in the history of the world to win custody back from a non-handicapped person.
No way.
And one of the first males in the United States to win custody back from a female, which is still almost impossible, but it became a landmark decision. So those two stories together kind of make up the book and the story. And so it's baseball, but it's, you know, it's human interest in baseball mixed together.
Yeah. I mean, when I actually bought the book and we were reading up on it, it's actually crazy. When your dad is growing up in the era like the Jackie Robinsons, almost the comparisons of the prejudice that the both of them got, and it's just an amazing story. And he actually get close with Jackie Robinson and talk with him a lot?
He did, yeah, because Jackie Robinson's first game was, everybody thinks, you know, the Brooklyn Dodger, but he played in Jersey City in 1947, was the first integrated baseball game. It was the minor. There was Jersey City Giants versus Montreal Royals, and Robinson was playing for Montreal, but the stadium was sold out. They gave all the kids in Jersey City off for the day to go see the game, and Jackie Robinson hit a home run against the hometown team, and he got a standing ovation because people were seeing history. So my dad got to know him later on, and he talked to him about that day, and the two became really close friends. But it's funny what you mentioned, because when my father were first starting out, a lot of players would not talk to him because they saw him as this token blind guy. And, you know, he was just given a job because he's handicapped. But it was guys like Willie Mays and Bob Gibson and Jackie Robinson who would talk to him. And it wasn't until we were writing the book that we started putting two and two together and saying, wait a second, all the people who did talk to you were guys who had gone through pretty much the same thing, that, you know, they were on the outside and they had to push their way in. So it was interesting that's, you know, they saw common ground between the two of them.
That's an incredible story. And all right, and like I said, I recommend people getting that book, Seen Home. But one other reason why you're joining us tonight, I know you got another book coming out. If people don't know, you are a Disney historian and Disney enthusiast, and you're coming out with this book, Top Disney. It's a really interesting concept, I see, where you kind of take some of the, like a top 10 where everybody thinks it's an opinionated thing, and you kind of turn it into making it a story. How did you come up with this idea?
It's been about 20 years in the making. I you know, I've read a lot of books. I have a library of over 400 books about Disney history and about Disney himself. And so one day I was actually on a cruise line, a Disney cruise line, and I was saying to myself, boy, there's no book where it's like top 10 lists of the top 10 characters or rides. And so it started germinating back then. And then I contacted the Disney archives, and Dave Smith, who just passed away, was the man who built the whole archives and put it all together. And I reached out to him, and he called me right back. And I said, has anyone ever done anything like this? And he said, oh, no. And he said, I'll give you all the help you need. So between projects with all the acting and my dad's book and everything, I've been kind of working on it here and there. But that was one of the challenges when you write a book, any book. And I encourage people, everybody's got a story in them. Everybody's got a book there. But what you have to figure out is, what can I say about this subject that nobody else has said before? Because if you write a book that's just a rehash of every other book, then it's not that. And so my choice with this one was to tell the story of Walt and the company through Top Ten List. So it almost takes you, it's not quite chronologically, but it sort of is. And it gives you, you know, through these little lists of history of how the company got to where it is today, and how the characters evolved from point A to point B and all those different things. So I tried to make it as interesting as I could, you know, because sometimes lists can get boring or you kind of lose interest in. And it's not meant to be a page turner where you have to read it from page one until the end. But it certainly, if someone does, that was my goal, is to keep you reading if you wanted to go through where you would say, oh, I want to find out what happens next. But it's also a book that you could pick up and open to any page and read from there, too, because it's self-contained lists.
What do you think was the first thing that got you into Disney? The parks, the movies? What aspect? Because there's so much to their media, it's hard to begin. But what do you think made you a Disney lover?
I can tell you exactly what made me a Disney lover was I was 5 years old, and my grandmother used to take us into New York City all the time because we lived right across the river, and we went to see Walt Disney's Robin Hood at Radio City, which was one of the last movies ever played at Radio City before they stopped showing movies there. And it wasn't just a movie. There was a whole stage show with the Rockettes and Mickey Mouse and all that. And then after the movie's over, the Rockettes came back out and Mickey came back out. And right there, I fell in love with not just Disney, but with show business. So I knew that, and I said, okay, I want to be that. I want to be on stage or on screen and performing. And then I also kind of, after that, started reading Disney books and watching Disney movies and watching the TV show. And we didn't get to the parks until like 76 or so, about 5 years after it opened. So that just cemented it. But yeah, kind of that first exposure. And I think that's, if you ask any kid who loves Disney, they'll tell you that. It's usually the first movie or the first TV show or the first book. And that was mine. And that was before you had VHS and DVD and you could watch whenever. Right. It was kind of, you were limited to whatever was on Sunday night on the Wonderful World of Disney.
So you touched on something I wanted to ask you. So obviously there's different time periods as far as Disney goes, and you think of what they are now, which is essentially they own what seems like everything, and you know, obviously you're in 3D animation now for a long time. Now, do you still have the same passion as far as like newer products that Disney puts out in this modern era of Disney as much as like maybe a more nostalgic era of like, you know, when you were a child and the kind of things you were talking about? Or is it kind of all go together and you still have the same passion for their product?
Well, you know, it's funny. You're asking me that about Disney, but I could ask my father the same question about baseball and he would give the same answer I would give, is that you love the old stuff and you have that, you know, nostalgia for it and all that, but you know that it has to move on and then right. You embrace the new stuff. So the same thing with my dad, when I ask him about all these new rules, and I expect him to come back and say, oh, I hate that because that's not, but he says, hey, listen, the game's got to progress and you don't pick up new fans unless you're in the game. And you see many studios now that have fallen by the wayside and many animation companies because they just didn't continue.
Right.
And that's what's good about Disney, is there have always been, and that was Walt. Walt was always at the forefront of technology. He was always moving on to the next thing. He didn't sit and rest on his laurels. He said, let's try that. If he were alive today, he'd be fully in love with, you know, streaming services and 3D and all that other stuff. He'd want to make the next thing. So, I love, for instance, I saw the new Dumbo the other night, and it's gotten mixed reviews, but I thought it was terrific because it was a genuinely heartfelt new way to tell the story. It's the same story, but they kind of added a little more human touches to it. So I'm not upset. Some people are offended that they would ever remake Dumbo, but that's, you're moving on and you're bringing a whole new audience.
Yeah, I saw it a couple nights ago. It was pretty good. And I thought I liked Danny DeVito and his secretary, Sandy Martin. We actually interviewed her about 6 months ago or so.
She's very funny in the movie. She's got a terrific part in there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, Chris, normally it's just me and Scott on the show, but next to me right now is my wife, the lovely Miss Isabel. We're currently in her Disney office.
Oh, hello.
And I am surrounded by tons of figurines and stuff. I will actually send you pictures of this room. We took a while to do it, but of all the interviews that we have done with actors and athletes and stuff like that, you were the one where she said, I have to get on. So
she
wants to ask you something. So, honey, why don't you take it away?
Oh, wait. Now can you hear me?
Hello, yo. It's surfing. Sounds like my kind of room, by the way. Thank you. That's awesome.
Thank you. Yes, I am a Diz nerd also. And I want to say that I really enjoyed your book.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. That means a lot coming from a super Disney fan.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. So you started to touch on one of the questions that I was going to ask you about live action films and what your opinion was of them. So I'm going to piggyback off of that and ask you, what would you like to see as a live action Disney film?
Steamboat Willie.
Yeah, that was
good one.
That's a very good question. Somebody asked me that the other day, and there's so many choices, but I would like to see them go back to some of the other ones that are kind of more obscure. They're animated films, like they're little vignettes from Make My Music and other ones that were shorter parts of it, but like Johnny Appleseed and Pecos Bill, and I know they sort of did a live action, but stuff like that, that people, it'll give them an opportunity to see the old one and be exposed to it, or the Sleepy Hollow that I know Johnny Depp did a Tim Burton version, but it wasn't Disney, but I'd like to see them do the Disney version as sort of live action. So people get upset when you do Cinderella and when you do Beauty and the Beast, but if you did something that's not as well known or is sort of a little bit off the beat in their canon, I think it would be better embraced and would highlight that movie that most people don't know about or are not aware of.
Yeah, Aladdin coming up. Do you think that Will Smith could redeem himself already with that one picture? He's kind of gotten a bad rep.
I take a view when movies like this come out. I always hold off my judgment until I see the actual movie, because it tends to happen a lot where people see the trailer, they see an unfinished thing, and they start. Then all the critics come out, and then suddenly the movie comes out, and they're like, well, that wasn't so bad. So with Will Smith, I've seen everything that everybody else has, and, I kind of have the same opinions, but they're still not done, I'm sure, with the CGI and with all the stuff. So when it comes out, then I'll decide whether or not I'm – but, again, you have to – Robin Williams is not around anymore to do it. So
exactly.
If you're going to pick somebody charismatic, and that's what – so it'll be his version. It's also a personal thing, because as an actor, I've been called upon to play roles that have been played by other people before, or to step in for a role that someone's been playing for a long time. And it's a challenge, because people want to see the stuff the other person was doing, but you want to bring your own take to it. So I understand what he's going through.
Yeah. I mean, on Broadway, they did an excellent job. I saw it on Broadway, and all the guys who played Genie did an excellent job.
Yeah. And that's a good example. That's a great example. The Broadway shows have, especially Aladdin, have done it. I went to see Aladdin last year, and I didn't even think of Robin Williams. It was Major Attaway was the actor playing Genie, and he was just phenomenal. And Robin, in the beginning, I was like, okay, I remember the Genie, but he made it his own. And that's really the challenge. What you have to do as an actor is make a role your own. We've seen it with James Bond, with Batman, where people get, I can't believe this guy is Batman. People forget when Michael Keaton was cast. There was outrage. Oh, there was no social media back then, but people said, how dare they put a comedian as – and now you see people begging Michael Keaton to come back and play the older –
he did phenomenal.
Yeah, so that – I think Will Smith will find – he'll always be people that are going to be angry that it's not Robin Williams, but they'll be – he'll have his followers and his devotees. And there's a kid out there who has never seen the original Aladdin or didn't grow up with it like we did, that this will be their Aladdin. And
that's true.
They'll fall in love with this and then eventually see the Robin Williams one. So we're seeing it from our viewpoint of knowing the old one, but there's a whole generation out there that doesn't know that old one or is not as familiar with it.
Now, Chris, let me ask you something. I've always been, whether it's an artist or a musician or I don't know. I'm always fascinated by, you know, because doing comedy and whatnot, everybody's a different type of writer. Now that you've got two very different books published, complete polar opposites. What is your, like, a lot of people have the idea one day, hey, I want to write a book and I got an idea. But what is your writing process? Are you like a word for word kind of guy? Are you a guy that throws stuff up against a board and just has general ideas, or you write every day for a certain amount of time? What is your writing process?
Well, that's the last one you mentioned is the key thing. If you're going to be a writer, you have to write every day, even if it's, you know, just 10 minutes, even if it's a small little thing. I write blog posts. I'll do guest things. Just to write something. So keep yourself. It's like a muscle. You got to keep yourself. It's like going to the gym every day, just keeping yourself in practice. But I'm kind of a mix of all those things. I have stacks of notes all over my house of this would be a good idea and that would be a good book and all. And sometimes I return and sometimes I don't. But it's, you know, it's your mind creative. But for anybody who wants to write something, first of all, don't be afraid. Just sit down and start writing. Let it flow from you. Don't edit yourself. Just put it all out there on the computer or on paper and then look at it later. Put it aside. Come back to it. But that's the thing. You just got to get the process going and start. And everybody's got a story. Everybody's got something interesting to put out there. And I can tell you, even Stephen King and some of the more pop, you know, all the great John Grisham and people who have all these best-selling, they still, when they're done with a story, they say to themselves, I wonder what I'm going to do. You never know where it's going to come from, and you always fear that, is that it? And I've said to myself, boy, I've got two books. Is that it? Am I done? Do I have anything else in it? It'll come. There'll be something there. So that's the, if you really want to create or write or do something like that, then don't let those little negative doubts in your head stop you. Just go ahead and do it. And, you know, what's the worst that can happen? You'll have it written and either you'll decide no one will see it or you'll have it and you'll bring it to somebody and say, hey, what is it? Can you read this? Do you think it's pretty good?
So what's your upcoming goals? Do you have any preference on do more acting, do more writing? What do you see yourself a few years from now?
Well, it's a good question. It's the way I see myself is, and this is going to be a really dated reference, but the old Ed Sullivan show, the guy spinning plates and running back and forth between the plate, that's sort of me right now. I have my acting plate going over here that I'm running over to the writing, and then I also do now, they've got me booked on a lot of speaking tours. I'll go out and I do a show about Walt Disney where I play Walt Disney, and I've been doing that at libraries and universities and kind of a one-man sort of like Hal Holbrook, Mark Twain thing. And then I also do motivational speeches either about my dad or through Disney. And now recently, which is very odd, I've been called by museums and other things to do top 10 lists specific to whatever they're – I'm going to be doing one for the top 10 Disney-Italian connections. You wouldn't think – and there are. Believe it, I found like 20 of them. So each museum is having me – I'm doing one at a circus museum that's going to be all about Disney circus connections. I'm doing one at the – Comedians Museum, Comedians Hall of Fame. So that's the fun thing with this book is that I could have gone on even more lists that were specific to different things. So I have a blog. It's topdisneyblog.com, and it's got some of these lists that didn't make the book or new lists. And so that's it's hard to answer your question in one way, but yeah, it's like doing a million different things. But the acting, I still primarily consider myself an actor. That's what I was born to do. It's what I've been doing since I was 14 years old. And writing has kind of taken hold a little bit the last couple of years, but acting is my first love and passion. And I'm lucky. I'm doing a theatrical show that I do at least 5 or 6 shows a week. So I keep that muscle working.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And as you were talking, my wife grabbed a piece of paper and was writing down everything you said. She's hysterically trying to get all information. She's trying to beg me to ask you if you're coming to Atlanta to do one of these shows.
There's a couple that Georgia is on the schedule. I'm not sure how close we're getting to Atlanta, but there's a couple of things because one of them was just the other day, actually, the person reached out to me, some railroad museum down in Georgia, and I don't know the exact town it's in, but they want me to come down there because they were part of the Great Locomotive Chase, which was a movie in the 50s from Disney. So they want me to do a thing about Disney and trains and railroads and Georgia history with Disney. So, and there's believe it or not, there's a lot of Georgia history too. So,
oh, awesome. Yeah. So if people want to find out more about you and keep on track on what you do, where can we keep up with you?
The newest thing is it's through the book. It's called topdisneyblog.com, or you can go to topdisneybook.com, which is specific to ordering the book. But on there, there's a way to contact me, and there's a little bit of information about me. And it'll post. There's no dates listed yet, but they're going to announce this week some of the places and things that we're going. So there's a part on there that lists the tour dates, and there's a little bio of me. And so, yeah, if anybody wanted to follow what's going on with the book or follow some of the unique new lists or where we're going, that's the best place. So it's topdisneyblog.com.
Awesome. And so she doesn't yell at me. Izzy, you have one question?
I put speaker on instead.
Okay, it's no problem.
If anyone would know the answer to this question, you would. I read on Facebook. I know. If it's Facebook, it's true. I read that Walt Disney once upon a time tried to negotiate putting Disney World in New York City, but it fell through in another park.
Yes, that's absolutely true. There were a few locations. One was St. Louis. He wanted to build where the new Busch Stadium is, or where the before Busch Stadium was built, and that fell through. And then the other one was not quite in New York City, but the Meadowlands, actually right where I live now, where Giant Stadium is.
Jersey.
That was going to be the spot. And then there was another one was Colorado. So three locations, and all three, the main reason it didn't work was the weather, that Walt could not justify opening a park for 6 months a year. And at the time, it would have been too expensive to enclose it. But originally, Epcot Center was going to be here in the Meadowlands.
Oh, who knew? Yeah. I know that 1964, It's a Small World. The sure. Carousel of Progress were at the World's Fair. My mom was a huge fan of both of them.
Wow. Yeah, and there were two others. It was not the Hall of Pride, but Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln that inspired the Hall of Presidents. That was at the World's Fair. And then Ford had one called Magic Skyway that you would go through, and it was a diorama, which was about how the dinosaurs became fossil fuel, and they had all these dinosaurs and the seats would move around. And if that sounds familiar, it eventually became the Universe of Energy in Epcot that has since closed. But
yes,
it wasn't called the Universe of Energy, but that was the same. They brought that down later on to Epcot. But Walt, the 64 World's Fair was his test to see, because everybody said, oh, East Coasters are too sophisticated and they're not going to go to a silly little theme park. And then he wound up showing them that, hey, people are going to the World's Fair and they're coming for Disney stuff, then there should be one on the East Coast. But Florida won out because of weather and location and the fact that he was able to buy 28,000 acres for nothing. So.
Can you imagine the Giants playing next door to Disney World?
with
Xanadu sitting in the background.
Actually, do you have time for one? Can I put one quick story?
Ahead.
So it ties in, actually. It ties in everything we talked about, New Jersey and the Yankees and Disney. And all. So in the 1950s, there was a guy who came to all the Yankees, the big ones, Yogi Berra, Phil Rizzuto, Mickey Mantle, Whitey Ford, and said, I've got swampland in Florida, and it's going to be this big thing, and I'm going to sell it to you. And so they all bought it at like $25 an acre, and it turned out to be worthless land because nothing could be done with it, and they couldn't drain it. And so they were all stuck with this land. And then in about 1964, this mysterious company came to all them and said, hey, you know, we want to buy that land, and we'll give you $75 an acre. And they all jumped on it. They were like, oh, hey, we're making our money back. We haven't done anything except for Yogi Berra. He hung on and said, no, I'm going to build a house there one day. I'm going to go retire. And he would not sell. And then a year later, the word got out that it was Disney and they were building a park there. And those same little acres of land went from $75 an acre. It jumped up to $150 an acre. And Yogi still would not sell, and he held on to it. Even after they opened Disney World, he still owned one of the little pieces. There was only a few people that still had parcels of property there.
Nice.
And he finally sold it to them for $15,000 an acre.
Wow.
Somewhere in like the late 1970s. So where Hollywood Studios is now, one corner of their park over by where Gertie the Dinosaur is, that was Yogi Berra's land.
Wow. And people said Yogi Berra was stupid.
No, he was certainly not. I knew the man well. He played them.
I thought you were
just seeing Yogi. Coming out from
this
front door. Turn off that door. Get off my lawn.
That sounds like Yogi too.
Cool.
I thought you were going to say they held on to their land and it turned out to be like the investors from Xanadu. It's a big failed project.
Oh, that's what Xanadu. Yeah, that. Let's see if that. I can look out my window right now and see it, and it's been there
lucky
for 10
you.
Years.
Lucky you.
There's a big picture of SpongeBob waving, and everybody's saying, "I'm ready." Literally, it says, "I'm ready," and hopefully that'll be open before my kids are, you know, senior citizens. We'll see.
Chris, it's been awesome.
We really appreciate the time that you gave us. We thank you so much, and good luck with the book and everything in your future.
Well, thank you so much. I'm honored that you had me on.
Chris.
All right, so Izzy's going to join us now as we interview Sean Kemp.
Ah, yes.
Sean, do you ever put ears on?
When you were dunking.
No, not the governor of Georgia. Yes, that's who we're interviewing, honey.
When you were dunking over people, did you ever have ears on? Did you ever think, what's my favorite Disney movie as soon as I'm dunking on somebody's faces? When you passed the ball to Gary Payton, did you pretend that you were Aladdin or the genie? Discuss.
He just goes up for a dunk. You never had a friend like me. Make it rain.
Take you on a magic carpet ride. All right, Chris Lucas. All right, Mike, it is time for a guest here. Now, I was contacted recently about a band with quite an interesting name, a name of Thumpasaurus. Thumpasaurus, you know.
I guess they're George Clinton and P-Funk fans.
It seems that way. They have quite the kind of old funk style that became popular for a while. You definitely get some George Clinton in there for sure. But yes, we are going to interview Lucas, who is the lead singer of Thumpasaurus. We're going to check them out. They got a tour coming up, and they just played South by Southwest, and it should be a good time. So let's do it.
Sounds like a plan, Scotty.
So, Lucas, first off, thanks for doing a few minutes with us here. And where are we calling you at? I know you guys are based out of L.A. Where are you guys currently?
Yeah, that's where we are now. We just got off of a month-long run, and so we're just kind of recouping.
Yeah,
just hanging out in L.A., just doing some stuff, doing some writing and whatnot. Yep.
Nice. Yeah.
Now, Lucas, I got to ask you, though. I was in researching this interview tonight. I was on the Funkasaurus Twitter page, and from what it said back in January 20th, I should be talking to Jimmy Buffett right now.
Oh.
What happened here?
Oh, what happened? With Jimmy? Oh, wow. I talked to Jimmy. He has a way higher paying gig. So that's what happened with Jimmy. Jimmy's all about the money these days. Not really. I like Jimmy. But I don't know if you saw that. What was it? It was the Saints. The Rams? It was like, yeah, some playoff game where he...
Yeah, the Saints-Rams one with the pass interference, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. Did you happen to see that with the mic drop and Jimmy Buffett?
No.
No, I don't think I saw that.
Yeah. He sang the national anthem, and that's kind of where that came from, and he just totally bombed it.
Oh.
And he did this mic drop at the end, and then it was pretty wonderful. And then Twitter was exploding, so that's where that came from. That was sort of the inspiration.
What level bad was it? Was it like Carl Lewis bad, Roseanne Barr bad, or just slightly above that?
It was like so bad that it was it was good. It was like, but he was. I think he was aware of it. It was like, I don't give a shit kind of bad, where like he just blew through the thing in like 25 seconds, just sang it as fast as he could. Just didn't hit any notes or try, really.
That's
just
awesome.
Really.
That kind of makes me like Jimmy Buffett more.
No, I definitely shed some light on Jimmy for me.
Tommy Bahama shirt and just blowing through the national anthem. Who cares? Like, but
yeah, if you get a chance, definitely YouTube it. Right.
That's happening after the show. Now, I know you guys were just recently at South by Southwest, correct?
Mm-hmm.
How
yeah,
that,
we were.
How was that? Was that your first time there?
It was,
or?
Yes, it was. It was cool. Henry just got here, so
hey,
Henry really liked it. I know.
Yay, Henry's here.
What's up, guys?
Henry, what's going on?
Henry. It's
Scott and Mike here.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good, man. Good.
Well.
I was just saying, Lucas, you guys just got home from South by Southwest. What was that like for the first time, Ben?
Oh yeah, man. I mean, I loved it. You know, for me, that's like the zone to be in, is like you're around so many other awesome bands and you get free drinks in the artist area and go out and see some bands and meet a bunch of people and, you know, come back for more drinks and play your own show. And there's just people walking around. And if you're loud enough, which I think is our specialty, people will come and, like, you know, when we played on the main street, like, the venue was like oversold and people would be like gathered in the streets watching from behind us. And
awesome.
You know, I think it's a good place for Thumpasaurus in that respect, where it's just people milling around.
No.
And you come with some outrageous shit, they'll listen to you.
Now, did you guys get to do multiple spots, or it was like a one night kind of thing?
Yeah, we played four shows.
Oh, perfect.
Overall. And they were all kind of different. And, It was South by sort of like a smorgasbord shit show. So we just kind of popped in and out of these four places to various levels of crowd size. And I think it was awesome every time we got to play.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Yeah, it was cool.
I think a big factor for us was that we were coming off the back end of our U.S. tour. So, you know, I think if you go out there and you're like, oh, my God, South by, this is our chance, and you know, we're spending all this money to get out here and blah, blah, blah. I think that's probably where a lot of the, like, negative stories of by you here come from, kind of been, like, hoping for it to be this, like, amazing, worth it. We're going to fly or drive to Texas and pay for a hotel for a week and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
But because we were coming off of our tour, we kind of had our infrastructure rolling already. And, you know, thanks to the people who bought merch on tour, we weren't like absolutely wrecking ourselves financially to be there. And so that really helped the experience, I think, rather than going out and making an isolated incident. It was like our vacation at the end of our tour.
Nice. now let's get into the band a little bit. Over the last 2 weeks or so, while setting this up with Brittany, we kind of dove into some of your music, and you got a lot of different vibes going on. I mean, I guess for me, I hear a lot of like P-funk and maybe a little bit of Devo in there, with kind of a good sense of humor, but some very, very interesting riffs going on, bass playing, percussion. So a lot of different things going on. First off, what is your guys' background? Were you guys like into funk and dance, or was this something you guys as a band decided you want to go for this sound? Where did this sound evolve from?
It actually evolved from a banjo guitar folk duo, which seems out of left field, but that was like the very earliest iteration of what was to come. And it was sort of, it was definitely softer in volume and less rhythmic. But we decided we wanted to play house parties, and then the band kind of our banjo guitar wasn't cutting it for like drunk college kids. I've always loved like rock and roll and funk and jazz, and and so I was kind of chomping to get a chance to be able to play that stuff in the house parties, where it was sort of like a easy evolution to getting louder and more rambunctious. And then more people came on, and we started experimenting with sounds and getting a little more conceptual. And then we kind of realized that doing this stuff was a lot more fun and maybe a little less sappy than the folk route. So it was just kind of, it was easy to transition into what Thumpasaurus is becoming, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I've been watching a lot of your videos and stuff, and it seems like you guys really like feed off the audience and like really have a good time with everything. Is that something that's kind of hard when you're like recording an album, to kind of bring it back to a studio when it's just you guys, to kind of get the same kind of excitement and sound that you get from a live show?
Well, it's kind of weird because we normally record the songs before they go out live. So I'd say the jury's a bit out on that one. We normally, the first time we play a song is the recording of it. We get together and figure stuff out, and, you know, Lucas will bring in a demo or someone will bring in a riff, and we'll just kind of evolve it out from there. And so a lot of the times the first real iteration of the song is the studio version. Mm-hmm. And then we play it for like 2 years after that. And at some point in that process, I feel like we hit a point where we're like, oh, this is how the song goes.
Yeah.
So it's kind of this moving benchmark. And we definitely feel like the studio process for us is in a constant state of evolution, like what even that workflow is like. So, TBD.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you guys, obviously, there's a lot of keyboards and synth going on. So I guess this question is a little bit more for Henry. As far as drums, are you playing both, live kit and electric kit? Are you playing synth stuff at the same time? Or how does that work for you?
Yeah, so we have our percussionist Nate, and I've done this at times too when he can't be there, who's running the SPD.
Mm-hmm.
So like if there's little, you know, like karate chop sounds
or, naturally, you know,
screaming or shit like that that we have come up with in the studio that is cool to have on the track, we'll trigger it off of there. But it's a pretty acoustic, in terms of not like acoustic instruments, but terms of live in the room,
right?
It's a pretty live.
Yeah, it's a live band. Like, we've never done tracks. Not saying no to anything, but yeah. I think because so many of the guys have jazz backgrounds, or we all have live music backgrounds, and it's way more fun to beat off each other and not really have to worry about a metronome going or like hitting cues to songs, because it's a lot of times improvisational,
right,
as well. So it's way more fun for us.
Now, my favorite thing, I was talking to Brittany, just getting some info on you guys. One, you might be the only band with two Henrys in one band. and two, my favorite was, you know, you got drummer, guitar, bass, keyboard, sax, percussion, and digital keys, and then you have Ben Benjamin, who plays PowerPoint. Explain that. Now, I know a lot of paint the picture for your live show. I mean, I'll help. People who don't know you, Thumpasaurus has some very interesting outfits. They got some screens going on. Tell us a little bit about your, I guess, presentation and also about what Ben does.
Yeah, so the first official Thumpasaurus show was this little backyard show when we were seniors in college, which is about 3 years ago now.
In our actual backyard.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we just kind of see. But the band, the proof of concept for the band was trying to match up sort of internet culture and PowerPoints to our brand of funk music and kind of just seeing what that would feel like to people viewing that. And it kind of started with like Jennifer Lawrence pictures and just kind of like really stupid stuff we could find, but it was all very intentional. So it started as just like a really crude PowerPoint that we ran the visuals off PowerPoint. And since then it's kind of evolved to it's gotten a lot more complicated and fluid, but it's all been very intentional. So we always have treated the visuals as like an acting member of the band, because it's like our sounds and visuals are completely integrated. And so that's why we semi-joke that, right, Ben is an instrumentalist, but he's instrumental to the band for sure.
You should have him like do a whole like pyramid scheme PowerPoint during one of the songs, like selling, trying to get recruit people to sell something.
Yes, we're open to anything dumb and good.
It was a great concert, and I got an awesome time here in Mexico. Can't complain. I mean, you guys are so unique in what you do. Is it almost more fun to play for people who don't know who you are and don't expect what's coming versus like regular fans? Or do you feel like you need to like have an audience that knows you really well when you get up there?
For me personally, I think both are pretty awesome experiences, and definitely for this tour we got to experience both, and it kind of keeps you guessing every night. Like, you never know what you're going to get. You never know, like, if there's going to be six people in the audience that know you or 250. And like, the ones where people know us, where it's like a lot of people, for example, like LA, we just played a show at the Terragram, and it's like, it kind of allows the energy to just sort of skyrocket into crazy places. But like, shows that people know us less, it's kind of just fun to see people's reactions and like get them on board. And that's kind of like a cool victory in itself, which is really fun for me. I don't know what Henry.
Yeah, I feel like our baseline is, the band was sort of developed through these like tools for first time listeners, you could say, like the PowerPoint and the just sort of the tone of the music and the stunts that we do during the shows sometimes. It's all kind of to just make people be like, I don't know what this is, but like, wow, like, okay, I fuck with it. And
yeah, I like this, but yeah. I don't know how or why.
It's definitely like, if people have no idea if they like it or not for the first, you know, few minutes of the set too, like, that's a total good thing, I think. Just like being surprised. for better or for worse. And I really like that. I think that that feels good, and I think that that's like what normal feels like for us right now with the position we're in. And it's crazy when people do come together and know the songs, and like, we've started to be able to play our own headlining shows that are pretty full in certain places, and that feels like, oh wow, like the weights are off. Like, it almost feels like cheating, sort of.
Right.
Now, like, oh wow, people just are on board of this, and it just feels like flying a little bit.
That's awesome. Now, you tell me about the Book of Thump and this opera starring John Travolta. where did this come from, and what exactly is it?
Yes. Well, without giving too much away of the mystery, because we don't exactly know. No, we know. The Book of Thump is like the Bible or our biblical text in our mythology, in which we operate out of. It's called the Thumpiverse, which is sort of like an umbrella universe for all our characters and concepts and little narratives that, if you want to, as like a pay-as-you-go situation, you can read into all these things just off our content, basically.
Metaphorical.
Yeah, yeah. Pay in value or in fun.
Okay.
And so that was sort of our tie-in for our first album we did, was the Book of Thump being sort of like the Ten Commandments or the preamble to this. they're full of little lessons and grooves and jigs.
There is a literal Book of Thump, but there's only one copy.
Yes, and it's buried. It's buried in the northwest, but that's
a story for another time.
Yes.
Yeah, it's on Barnes & Noble right now. Yeah. Only one remaining. So.
It's like that one Wu-Tang album they released.
One copy and one Barnes & Noble in Seattle.
It's like that when Wu-Tang released that one album and like there was only one copy of it.
Yeah, that's cool.
but it's funny, you tell me all these rules and somehow I still don't hear how John Travolta got wrapped into this.
Oh, so John Travolta's sort of like a demigod of our universe. And he's called the Decider. Yeah, everyone... there's all these things, parts floating around, but we kind of get to make up our own rules, which is pretty nice. So, like, we wanted John Travolta, and then he was a demigod. It's kind of like that. But it's all true. So it's not like we're pulling it out of nowhere, even though we are. Because
Now, how much acid is present during the writing of the book, Book of Thump?
Well, I think what's surprising to a lot of people is that we're, like, a very sober band overall. especially compared to like most people we know and artists. But I don't know. I think we've all dabbled in.
Yeah, don't get us wrong. We've been there.
Yeah, like,
but it's you know, we're pretty.
It laid down the some of the bedrock.
Yeah, maybe. we feel like we're just like living in.
Yeah, this stuff I feel like makes the most sense to us. Like,
I love it.
Now, what incarnation of Travolta are we talking? Are we talking Welcome Back, Kotter? We talking Pulp Fiction? Please don't tell me this is a whole thing about his movie Gotti.
Well, I don't like the opera. It's 17 minutes long, and it kind of goes through. It's sort of like fourth dimension Travolta, where he's like one being, but he's a fluid being, and all his different stages and movies have wisdom to share. Huh. And so, if you watch that, you'll kind of see the whole arc and the narrative of John.
I love it.
It's Joseph Campbell's hero's journey told through Travolta. In a way, to put it in its simplest and maybe not most true form.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a hard one to like digest in one take. But so what's new for the band? What's on the horizon? Are you guys working on a new album? Are you going back out on tour anytime soon? Or is this down period?
Definitely not down period. Because we've got a lot going on, actually. Yeah, we have a new album in the works, a lot of new music. We're writing a whole bunch of music for an album after that, potentially. And we've got our first sort of big festival bookings are coming up, like Firefly and Electric Forest and Peach Fest.
That's awesome.
Workout Fest. It's been cool kind of just starting to see that this backyard experiment is starting to get some legs under it, and that people are coming to us.
Yeah,
and it's cool. It's growing. So this will be our first go at major festivals, and hopefully we just keep sticking until we trick the world that we're the most popular music and band, and sort of like Trojan horse our way into the mainstream culture.
Yeah, we think we're making pop music,
mm-hmm.
with just you know.
Right.
Outside or pop.
Yeah,
absolutely. There's room for you. There's room there.
Oh yeah.
Now I gotta ask you guys, with everything you talked about, with a band, with a PowerPoint person, with a opera about John Travolta being a god, is there anything, let's just say, like normal and structured about this band that you wanna like? Are you guys like one of them types, you think of all this stuff, but you also have a mandatory 6 p.m. writing meeting together every week?
No, actually, what's funny is Henry and I might go write music for, we scheduled a writing session. This is like our first scheduled thing ever. We're like, oh, we're going to choose this day, and that's going to happen in a couple hours. But in terms of I think what's normal, especially about Bumpasaurus, is I think like the universal stuff comes first, and that's where it all comes from. And then just as sort of packaging and fun ways to not be boring or repetitive, we throw all these universal things like that we all go through, like anxiety or love and crushes, whatever that is, and we just kind of just we put them into what entertains us, I guess.
That's awesome.
And so it we hope it's accessible. We want it to be accessible to everyone. We never wanted to necessarily alienate people. However, we're going to do what we like to do, so, you know, people can listen to whatever or view whatever. But it's normal. To us, this is, like, normal as hell. Like, all this stuff.
That's awesome.
That's the best type of normal. What's normal to you?
Yeah.
That's what I've been telling you, Mike, for years. But so I want to thank you guys for coming on. It's cool. It's cool to hear one, an original take on things, and two, that you guys are. It's obvious through your music and through your videos and through this little interview here that you guys are enjoying yourselves, which comes through. So that's definitely one thing that is very cool to see. if people want to go not only check your music out, but also see what's going on with you or give you a follow or check you out, what's the best place to go?
I'd say right now, like our Instagram page, which is just Thumpasaurus Music, and our Spotify channel, if you just type in Thumpasaurus on the search bar, it's probably pretty easy to find. And YouTube, same sort of deal. Apple Music, Bandcamp, we've got some merch up and in our vinyl that we're selling. So yeah, all those, I guess.
There's always thumpasaurus.com, but we're kind of rebirthing it right now.
And let's not forget about Twitter, where we found out about Jimmy Buffett joining the band. And also on March 18th, they rolled up beans for no good reason. Which, Scotty, as you recall, was my short-lived nickname during junior high. So thanks for the shout-out, band.
Hey, you got it.
Guys, thanks so much for sitting down. Well, not sitting down with us, I guess calling us from across the country. And we wish you luck with the band, wish you luck with the touring, and wish you luck with the music you guys got going forward.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks for taking the time to chat.
All right, Mike, from
the source. I think we've been doing things all wrong, Scott. I mean, this is like, if Whose Line Is It Anyway was a band,
right,
it seems like Thumpasaurus would be the thing. And I,
Thumpasaurus,
maybe we're looking at things a little too normally.
Thumpasaurus is right up our alley, you know, bunch of weirdos doing, having fun. You know, it's gotten them, it's definitely getting them recognition. Bunch of music festivals, Firefly Festival, South by Southwest, big music festivals. So, good for them, man. Fun guys.
Yeah, good stuff and all. I'm going to start an album about Ape Pagoda.
All right, well, there's room for you, Mike. You know, yeah. You know how I always encourage people to start their own podcast? You could start your own musical journey about Ape Pagoda.
I Googled it. Nobody's done it. It's online.
Maybe you could get
millions.
Is Ape Pagoda cover band, Douglasville Burloo. There's a lot of room for Burloo-themed entertainment. But I want to thank the guys from Thumpasaurus. All right, Mike, so the variety on Verbal Shenanigans continues. Disney, baseball authors, Thumpasaurus, funk bands. It's a variety show on the show, I guess you can say.
It's a plethora of potpourri.
A smorgasbord of audio.
Yeah. A random number generalizer of knowledge.
Yes. We were talking about former guests before. I did want to bring this up. Our good friend, good friend of the show, Lenny Dykstra is in the news again, Burlew.
Is he running for Congress?
Not yet. Not yet. I'm sure that'll happen eventually. But Lenny Dykstra, you know, former baseball player, former Philly, former Met, seems to always find his way in the news. Recently, before, he was letting squatters live in his house, got in trouble for that. Before that, he was attacked an Uber driver, which he got cleared of charges, apparently. But today he's in the paper or in the news for his former teammate Ron Darling, great baseball announcer for TBS and the Mets. Wrote about Lenny Dykstra hurling racial slurs and taunts at Oil Can Boyd during Game 3 of the 86 World Series.
Now, I somewhat remember Oil Can Boyd. He had a pretty decent temper back in his day, from what I recall.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I can't be shocked that them two weren't best of buddies. They don't seem like the two. It's like, come here, you. Let's go grab a beer at the end of the day.
So Ron Darling is claiming that during Game 3, Lenny Dykstra was just hurling all sorts of racial things. And the Oil Can was on the receiving end of the ugliest piece of vitriol I've ever heard in a bar on a baseball diamond anywhere, Darling wrote. Adding that the taunts were worse than anything Jackie Robinson might have heard. I don't want to be too specific here because I don't want to commemorate this dark, low moment in the Mets' history in that way. Now, okay, so Lenny Dykstra is rebutting this, obviously.
Okay.
He is saying that this never happened, and that he's just trying to sell books. Why would Ron Darling, a.k.a. Mr. Perfect, who's creating fiction to sell his latest dime store novel, want me as an enemy? Okay. And he tweeted that out. So now he's saying he's going to sue Ron Darling over this. Now, he says, you know, he's suing him over defamation. Now, here's the thing. You got to go with a little bit of track record, right? Believability. Ron Darling seems like a pretty put-together guy, you know, gets a lot of work, seems smart and educated. Lenny Dykstra, well...
Are you saying lesser?
Well, let's say Lenny Dykstra seems to find himself in trouble quite often and doesn't really seem to have a filter on his mouth whatsoever. I mean, go back to our episode and just listen to him talk about Daryl Strawberry or his special oral skills, I'll put it that way.
I mean, my first thought when I hear this story is, what kind of bars does Ron Darling go into where he had a good enough ranking where you can go, let me compare that to Lenny Dykstra with Oil Can Boyd? Like, I've gone to plenty of bars. I don't think there's many scenarios where I'll go, that's pretty racist. Where do I mark that?
Well, he said this was going on during a game.
Yeah, but for what I heard you say, he's like, that is worse than anything I've ever heard in, like, a bar or anything.
Oh, yeah.
So he's, I guess, going to somewhat racist bars every night, and then he's just like writing down notes, and all. It's like, that was decent, but not the worst I've ever heard. And all, you're not at Lenny levels yet, my friend.
Now, here's the thing, though. In defense of Lenny Dykstra, okay, of Lenny Dykstra, here's a guy, obviously, trying to sell books, right? And this had happened, so 86 was over 30 years ago, 33 years ago. Why bring it up now? Why you know, you have the whole team thing and dynamic. You know, things were done back then that would be looked upon very differently nowadays. But why bring that up now other than the reason to just try to sell some Page Six news, to try to sell a couple more books? And could Lenny Dykstra just be the easy target of this all?
I mean, I guess in theory, I mean, it's hard to say. It's kind of like saying, hey, somebody said OJ did something bad. And it's kind of like your first thought isn't, that's Page Six news. Your first thought is, I could see that.
Right.
Now, I'm not saying beyond a shadow of a doubt Lenny Dykstra did that. But, I mean, until I get more information, at least in my mind, I got to somewhat lean towards the Ron side versus the Lenny side until I get some more info.
Gotcha. All right. Well, I mean, I don't know. We'll find out more, I guess. But it seems like Lenny Dykstra, it also is, I feel like it's a little bit kind of talking out of school, though, right? Like, even if it did happen, you know, putting it in print to the New York media of all, you know, of course, do you think, even if it did happen, which obviously would be extremely awful, right? Wrong. Does that warrant 30 years later putting it in a book?
I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, anything that happens in your life is game if you're talking about your life. I guess another point is, if it happened, is this like something that's okay, it's an a-hole thing in this era, but back in that day, it's just like, all right, they're just really heated trash talking with each other, right, or something to the effect.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to condemn anybody or say I know the answer or anything like that. I mean, you put a gun to my head, or your thoughts, what do you think? It's like, all right, I could see Lenny did that, but at the same time, I have no idea the exact wording, what led to it. Did Boyd say something first where it's like, all right, we're going down to this level?
Yeah. It's
all going to be hearsay no matter what. So everybody's going to make their opinion, and probably only two people know the real answer.
Yep. Well, Our boy Lenny Dykstra staying in the news always.
Well, I got an idea, Scott. You still have his number. I'm pretty sure if you call up and say, hey, remember me? I'm Scott, your lawyer. What did you say that day?
All right,
I'm fairly confident we're going to get all the answers.
All right. You want to call him right now?
Do it. Okay. I dare you.
Okay. We are calling Lenny Dykstra. One, I forgot that we're on Skype currently. And two, I just called after I had hung up on you and no answer. Not even a dial tone. Like, no. So I think maybe Lenny might have changed his number.
Gotcha. You're coming through very robotic, the voice right now.
Domo arigato. Mr.
That's what it sounds like in this.
All right.
Now you're good.
Yeah. No. So no answer from Lenny, but, you know, it was worth a try. All I know is if I would have got an answer, you would have had to strap in for another hour and a half. Just get ready. Here we go.
Top flight investigation from verbal shenanigans.
Well, I guess before we get out of here, it's time for a classic, Bertlew. It's been a while. And obviously Lenny Dykstra is a perfect segue into bear news.
Bear news. We're talking about bear and shit. We're talking about bear and shit. It's freaking bear news. Bears in the world doing all sorts of things. Yeah, girl. You know I like them bears and shit.
Ooh.
Yes, folks. It is bear news. It is a bit that really doesn't make any sense, but we like to take three stories about bears, just because I have a general interest in bears, and kind of talk about them and talk about what's going on in the world of bears. So, Berlu, are you ready to hear three stories about bears?
Please lay it on me, Scotty.
Or would you prefer North Carolina and monkey stories?
Scott, and as fascinating as that story is, I feel I don't want to run out our course with that topic. I feel that can go on for months and months. So let's not wear out our fans just yet.
Well, let's also be serious. You know everything about it. So why beat a dead horse? Like, why keep going? So
that is true. All right. That is true.
Berlu, she freed a crying bear caught in a trap meant for mama bear. Now she's been sentenced to jail. Okay. Now, this took place in Vernon, New Jersey, Berlu, about 25, 30 minutes from where I'm sitting right now. An animal rights activist who admitted to helping free a bear from a trap in Vernon has been sentenced to 15 days in jail. Catherine McCartney, 50, of Vernon, is appealing the sentence imposed Tuesday by a municipal court judge. These animals are innocent, and so I made the moral decision to let the bear go so he could run back to his mother, and it was the right thing to do, she said in a statement to the court. She was sentenced to 15 days in jail last fall, but the same judge let her enroll in the Sheriff's Labor Assistance Program as an alternative, though she is appealing that sentence, too. McCartney and a second defendant in court Tuesday, Mark something or other, were hit with three summonses in October after helping a young bear escape from a trap at the Great Gorge Village condominium complex.
So what exactly is the official law that they broke?
I'm guessing what I'm thinking is it's like a bear hunt to try to keep away bears from this complex. And one was trapped, and she freed that bear from that trap.
Well, the bear went away. Did it make its mark, for lack of a better term?
I mean, I guess it didn't do much. I guess it went away. It says, in her statement, McCartney charged that the dumpsters in the area were not bear-proof, and that was the source of the problem. They were both hit with fines, $1,316. But Nagelhout, the other guy she was with, was a first-time offender. He was not given a jail sentence. An attorney for the anti-hunt bear group represented both of them in court, which is amazing that there's a whole group for that. They believe the penalties are extremely high and will be appealing. This bear cub was crying, and I think a lot of compassionate people would have done the same thing.
See, I just want to point out, this is an apartment complex, was it, Scott?
Yes.
Yeah. I lived in apartments.
I've broken into apartments.
I didn't get help from them whatsoever. So the fact that they were on their game with the Bears, I find it hard to find. I'm fairly confident that Bear had been there for about half a year before they would have finally checked the track.
I'll free it now. he's dead. All right. Well, I don't know how I feel.
The maintenance guy will be out there in a minute, Mama Bear.
I kind of feel like it even takes a little bit of guts to free a bear from a trap. That can't be an easy scenario. No. with the bear in pain, one, and then I'm sure Mama Bear is kind of lurking around, too. So, I guess this woman, you know, I don't find her too crazy. I think she's just trying to do something that, you know, she felt was kind of in her heart. But I think it's also messed up to be, like, arresting her, too. I don't know.
Yeah. You figure with all the things going on in this world, I think the last thing should be on her brain is, she let a screaming bear out of a trap.
Yeah. All right, brother. We'll lighten it up a little bit. Bear steals a family Subaru. So bear steals a family Subaru, takes it for a ride, and poops inside.
Sounds like my college years.
Living in the backwoods of Colorado, you'd come to expect a few wild bear sightings every once in a while. What you wouldn't expect, is for a big old bear to tiptoe in your driveway in the middle of the night, break in your car, relieve itself inside, and crash it into a mailbox, which is why a family was a bit startled to recently discover their Subaru ravaged in such a manner. So then they put a picture up of the inside of this Subaru is demolished. The steering wheel is off. The radio is hanging out. It looks like one of the airbags might have been deployed. At around 5 a.m. on August 4th, Durango resident Ron Cornelius, sweet name, was awoken by a commotion outside his front door, only to discover his neighbor's Subaru had plowed over some utility boxes and crashed into the mailbox. But it wasn't the aftermath, some wild teenager getting their jollies. It was the work of a bear. Usually I don't get up at 5 o'clock unless the bear is driving a car down the street. While the animal fled before anyone saw it, the interior of the vehicle made it fairly obvious the bear was responsible. There was an enormous claw marks across the dash, a bashed out rear window, and the radio and steering wheel had been completely turned off. There was also a steaming pile of bear poop left behind.
See, you absolutely know when they called their insurance company, they were coming up with something like, "Sir, you said you were going to be the only driver for this car on this policy. We can't help you. And it's not my fault you chose insurance, okay?"
The general. I saw Shaq in the commercial. I loved it.
It sounds like the farmers one and all. J.K. Simmons is going to come out, and we covered it. We are farmers.
Police suspect the bear broke into the car looking for food, and there have been hundreds of local reports of bears rummaging through people's trash bins following a late. Obviously, they always do it. They also believe the burly creature accidentally disengaged the parking brake, sending the car careening through various obstacles.
I really enjoy that CSI had to figure out what exactly happened.
It'd be funny if, like, the bear just had gotten in and the radio was on and it was just like some crappy, like, 90s alt rock station with like Limp Bizkit, and he's like, "Oh, I can't take it.
Blind Melon, no." I hate that stupid B song.
So that was a bear stealing a car and pooping in the car. So
bear steals a car. He gets scot-free. Woman saves a bear. She gets 15 days in jail.
Correct.
The moral of the story is just steal cars and take big dumps in them, kids.
Bear privilege. Bear privilege. Okay. All right. Finally, Berlo, wild bear attacks forest guard in India during rescue operation. Okay. According to reports, a team of forest personnel were trying to save a bear that was trapped in a reservoir. During the operation, the bear came out of the water, attacking the guard, and left him severely injured. The freak accident was reported on Thursday at the Valagu Reservoir, which is apparently in New Delhi, in the Kurnool district of southern India, state of whatever, blah, blah, blah. According to media reports, forest officials received information that a bear was struck in the reservoir, and struggling to reach the bank. So I guess he was stuck. A forest team rushed there to rescue the animal. Okay, there's even like footage here. The rescue team tried to help the bear, who was slowly approaching the bank. During the process, the bear escaped from the net and attacked a forest guard. The forest guard was lucky to survive and has been hospitalized. The bear was later captured and released into the nearby forest. Now, if that was if that was America, that bear would have been mutilate, like shot dead immediately.
Yeah. So this story didn't learn anything from our first two stories, Scott.
Right.
So clearly, if you want to be humane to save a bear, you got to throw it into a trap and then it'll allow you to let it loose. And then if the bear doesn't want to get caught, it gets into a Subaru and takes off.
So you're saying for our audience, anyone that wants to help a bear out, they should get a trap.
Mm-hmm.
Let it step in the trap, trap the bear, let it crunch its leg, you know, and then you're really doing your duty for the animal community.
But as you heard from our lady from Vernon, New Jersey, then you go up to the bear and just be like, no, it's cool. Then you let it loose and the bear goes wandering away. Now you go to jail after that, but at least the bear is safe.
Okay. All right. I like your thinking. Burlo, that's just another week of bear news. All right, Burlo. I think it is. I guess it's time to get out of here. I think it's time to go. Time to retire this episode. Put it to bed. Let the people of Pittsburgh cool down from how hot this episode has been.
Exactly. We had two great interviews. We learned so much about bears and monkeys, and you know, the world's a better place thanks to us. I mean, you're welcome, world.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure our listeners are very appreciative that we spent about 20 minutes on North Carolina bears. I mean, North Carolina monkeys, and then another like 15 minutes on bears. It's been a very animal centric episode. Dumpasaurus was with us today. So a lot of things going on. It's a pure variety show, is what you
bunch
get.
Of Disney critters running around also. So
yeah, none of those bears that sing and dance and talk appeared on the show today. But I guess with that, Burlo, let's get out of here. Anything to promote?
Yeah, since we did a Disney episode, I will hook up our friend Christine Rush. She is a magic travel specialist who can help you set up your next Disney or Universal vacation. She can help you schedule out your travel, accommodations, park visit, and cruise lines. She is also an expert in helping accommodate any family members with special needs. If you want to look into planning a vacation, find her on Facebook under facebook.com/Christine Magic Travel or email her at Christine@magictravel.com.
All right. And I will promote kind of something. Well, two things. I will promote, obviously, the Verbal Shenanigans comedy show, which happens once a month. This last week, I'll tell more about it maybe next week, was ridiculously phenomenal. And just a really good lineup at Tap House 15. We already have 50 reservations before the last show even went on for next month. So reservations are filling up quick. So next month is the very funny Kevin Israel, Griselle Cabrera, Ty Rainey, and myself. And there's one more person on there that I am forgetting. Griselle Cabrera, Ty Rainey, Kevin Israel.
I'm trying to look it up for you.
Oh, and Brett Druck. Sorry, Brett. Hilarious comedians. And myself, it's just a great time. So go check them out and go check out the people at Tap House and their amazing food and beers. And I want to promote, I had to pick up something from an old college friend the other day, something for the wedding that's coming up, which we'll dive more into as it's approaching 3 weeks from now, 3.5 weeks from now. Mm-hmm. A good friend of mine, Mike DiGiacomo, he has a company called Black Bear Woodwork. If you guys are into getting custom-made furniture or taking old products and making them look brand new or rustic and whatnot, go look up Black Bear Woodwork on Facebook, and you will see a whole bunch of his work. Really, really, really good stuff. Really nice stuff. So he does a really nice job, and he's trying to get that business launched off the ground. So custom furniture and all sorts of different things. And he helped me out, so Black Bear Woodwork. I guess before we go, Berlo, tell people where else they can find us. Where else can people find us?
Where else they can find us, Scotty? Well, we are on so many different internet radio podcast networks. As once again, I have to remind you, give me a thumbs up before we do these kind of things. We are on the DC
We're talking to
internet
Snake
radio.
Milker. No, Berlo. We already talked to Snake Milker.
Yeah, so we're on the BS Podcast Network.
Yes, been there for quite a while now.
Yep, we are on comingrightup.org on Wednesday afternoons at 12 p.m. We are on the DCN Internet Radio Network and their podcast network. And we are also on the weekends on WHBJ-DB, Cutting Edge Talk Radio. We're on Saturday and Sunday evenings there in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, so lots of places to go check us out other than your normal podcast platforms. If you are an internet radio listener or like a guy who likes podcasts, both of those you can find different ways to listen to us and also other shows, not just about us. There's a whole bunch of great programming on all those different things, so go check them out. Before we go, I want to give a shout-out to one of our longest-time listeners, Dom Bagnato, who pretty much has listened to every episode from the beginning. Right around when this episode comes out, he should be within a couple days of having his first child. So, Dom, this Woo-hoo! One's for you. You and Kim, who is also a former guest on the show, so good luck, guys, and
the episode's for you, Dom, not you, Kim. Yeah. You talked about getting a job earlier, if you recall. your whole I got a bump.
Wow, wait till I edit those together. And guys, life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep doing it. You're back, and we love you. Bye bye. See you next week.
Gotcha.